Chapter 20. Elith stood, stunned, unable to process all that had happened in only a few short seconds. The ground around her looked as though an errant orbital strike had torn a savage bite out the hillside, the rippling wake of its impact scarring the earth with jagged fractures and buckled crests. Motion drew her eye, and she saw Arbiter Oyun getting to his knees with effort, as though he'd been shot through the gut. He glanced up at her, face distorted with pain, and waved his hand, signaling he was okay. Or, no, calling her attention to the tree line. She followed the gesture, and the trail of debris and damage snapped together into meaning. Karush! She sprinted to the woods and found him crumpled on his side at the base of a tree, amid the scattered remains of the machine that had tried to protect him. The moment she crouched beside him, she knew he was gone. The front plate of his armor warped inward just right of his heart, as though it had been struck by a powerful hammer stroke, and blood trickled in a thin bright line across his lower lip, along his cheek, and dripped rhythmically from his jawline to the ground. Elith laid a hand on his shoulder, sorrow withheld only by disbelief. To her shock, he stirred at her touch. His eyes fluttered, but did not open. "Take off his armor," Oyun called from behind her. "The plate is restricting his breathing." Elith scrambled, but she couldn't find any latch, seam, or control to open it up. "I don't know how," she answered. But the Arbiter was there a moment later, kneeling next to her. He reached down and shifted Karush slightly, and then the upper portion of the armor unsealed and retracted its connectors from its components. Oyun lifted the damaged plate off and tossed it aside. Karush gasped deeply with the release, but wheezed and gurgled as the air flowed into his lungs. Beneath his armor, he wore a form-fitting layer like a thick shirt, black in color. Through it, Elith could see that a portion of his ribcage had been crushed inward where his armor had been. The labored breathing and blood in his mouth told her all she needed to know. There was nothing they could do to save him.
"Wari Karush," Oyun said. "Wari Karush, wake up!"
Elith rocked back on her heels, ice cold, devastated.
"Wari Karush, your commanding officer needs you!"
Elith laid a hand on the Arbiter's arm, but as she was starting to draw him back, Karush managed to force his eyes open. They were unfocused, wandering, and after a moment of watching him, she realized he couldn't actually see. The Azurim raised a hand, fumbled at his chest, and then reached to touch the Arbiter's knee and arm, and then the ground nearby. Not checking his wounds, Elith saw. Searching for his weapon, she reached over and pulled the chest plate closer and found the mechanism to release the void edge from its housing on the armor. Then she took Karush's hand in hers and gently pressed the sheathed weapon into his palm. His fingers wrapped around it, and he drew his arm back to his chest, over his heart. And though his eyes remained open, she knew he saw nothing as the great, final darkness descended upon him. An overwhelming sense of cruel injustice rent her spirit then, that this man, of all men, a man so devoted to his way and to a life of service, this lion of the Aziri, should fall in such a manner. She hadn't recognized it before, but seeing him so broken on the ground before her revealed how much she'd come to rely on his quiet strength as a sign that all would be well. That somehow, as long as he remained, nothing Quel's shadow had in store would prevent them from completing their task. And now, he lay with the last seconds of his life seeping into that cursed ground, cast there by the planet through the instrument of Varen's hand. And in that raw emotion, Elith refused the reality. Not merely refused to accept it, but rather refused its very existence. Long ago, the first house had taught her a technique for speeding the healing of her own body. She had never heard of it being used in an attempt to heal another, nor had it been designed to overcome such devastating trauma as Karush had suffered. But she was beyond all that now, beyond being held at the mercy of Quell's shadow and whatever forces of destiny seemed to be arrayed against her.
"Arbiter," she said, "move away."
He looked at her and then rose to his feet and moved back behind her. She laid her hand on Karush's ruined chest. Initially, she focused on the image as she'd been taught, that of snow-laden silver grass, its blades withered by the cold, its fragile life still clinging within them. But now, instead of tightly controlling her focus and filtering out all emotion, she allowed her complete self to pour into the moment, to drench her innermost being in the floodwaters of her unified heart, mind, and body. And from within that torrent, the deep language emerged, anchored by her teaching, translated through her inner voice. The deep releases its hold, dawn breaks on a world made new. Eleth felt the release of power flow through her. Dust and debris danced playfully away from her in all directions, as though chased by a spring breeze. But there was no other change. Karush didn't stir. His lifeblood continued its slow drip to the spattered ground. She sank down on both knees, her feet tucked under her, and waited there for a full minute, willing him to move or blink or breathe. Waited until she felt the Arbiter's hand on her shoulder. Her head dropped forward, and she closed her eyes.
"Eleth,"
Oyun said kindly. She knew what he was going to tell her. There was not time enough to mourn. Not now. And he was right. But the use of the deep language was not without cost, and after the shock of Varen's betrayal, she had no strength left to stand.
"I just need a minute, Arbiter," she said, "to recover."
He didn't answer, and he didn't take his hand from her shoulder. He just stood there behind her, present, silent. Eleth gathered what strength she could, willed it back into her muscles, demanded their submission to her mind. And when Oyun squeezed her shoulder, she nodded, opened her eyes, and struggled to rise. But as she did, he caught her arm, preventing her from standing, and spoke again.
"Eleth," he said, but this time there was something else in his voice.
He'd moved next to her. She looked up at his face, and then followed his eyes back to Karush.
The Azirim was breathing.
She settled back into a crouch, leaned over Karush, and was astonished to find that the collapsed portion of his ribcage appeared to be whole again. His breathing was deep, but not labored, and though there was still blood in his mouth, it had ceased its dripping. Soon after, his eyes opened, fixed first on the ground and then roving. He rolled away from her slightly, focusing on her face, obviously confused.
"It's okay, Karush," she said. "We're here. You're okay."
He looked at the surroundings, saw Oyun, touched his chest where his wound had been, and then gingerly patted his torso, undoubtedly searching for the damage. As he did so, he sat up and looked at her again.
"What did you do?" he asked.
"I used my art," she answered, not knowing how else to describe it.
"No, but," he said, "but what did you do?"
She shook her head, not grasping the intent of his question. Karush pushed her gently away from him and carefully got to his feet, keeping his eyes on her. She stood as well, backing up a few steps to give him space. The void edge was still in his hand when he took hold of the cuff of a sleeve and gently pulled it up, revealing his forearm. He stared at it for a long moment and then looked back at her.
"What did you do?"
It wasn't until he lifted his protective garment up to reveal his torso that she understood his reaction. The lifelong wounds of his flesh were gone. Wherever he looked, his skin was healthy, complete, with no sign of scarring. No trace of his long-suffered condition remained. But when he looked at her again, his eyes were intense, almost wild.
"I can't feel Subo," he said.
"We lost it," she answered. He ignored the statement, raised his sheathed weapon, and pointed its hilt at her.
"It would have been kinder to let me die," Karush said, restrained anger obvious in his voice and face.
But he glanced down at the void edge, and after a second or two of staring at it, he breathed a sigh of apparent relief and finally relaxed.
"Forgive me,"
he said, lowering the weapon back to his side.
"I'd feared you'd taken this from me."
"We would never take your weapon, Azirim," Oyun said.
Kourouche shook his head.
"I meant my capacity to serve," he said.
Eleth recalled then his explanation of his condition and how curing it would have somehow removed his ability to wield his weapons and remain part of the Aziri. From what she could tell, though, his staggering healing had not interfered after all.
"I can't feel Subo," he repeated.
"Subo tried to protect you," Eleth answered, and he nodded. It hadn't been a question, but rather a statement of acknowledgement that his machine companion was gone. He glanced around at the surroundings, taking it all in for the first time. When he noticed the front plate of his armor on the ground, he nudged it with his foot. Without remark, Kourouche released the other components of the upper half of his armor. The rear plating connected directly to a portion on his shoulders, and when he lifted it off, he paused to look at it, and then turned it sideways for the others to see. Where the front plate had buckled inward, the rear plate bulged outward in the same location. Eleth could scarcely imagine what must have happened to his internal organs, and the thought made his recovery all the more miraculous. Kourouche placed the components in a pile together on top of the damaged plates. Afterward, he reached into the collar of his shirt and removed a triple-looped necklace that she'd never seen before. When he held it up, though, it tumbled into a single large loop, and she realized it was the strap upon which he kept his void edge whenever he was out of his armor. He placed it over his shoulder, secured it, and attached the weapon in its rightful place. With that done, he detached the rest of his armor and placed it all together on the ground.
"I should have killed him after the storm," he said flatly.
He walked a few feet, crouched down, and picked up a handful of Subo's components off the ground.
"You couldn't have known, Wari Kourouche," Arbiter Oyun said, "and any blame should rest on me and me alone. I was the one who insisted on bringing him."
"I knew," Kourouche replied. "He changed after he went out. I could see it. But I hesitated, and now I have failed in both my duties."
He tipped his palm to the side, letting the segmented pieces pour back onto the ground.
"No one could have done more," Eleth said.
"You could have," he answered.
The statement wasn't accusatory, nor did he seem to expect a response, but there was a weight to it nonetheless. He stood again and crossed back over to where she and Ayun were.
"And you?"
he asked her.
"What about me?"
"You've touched this world as he did," he said.
She understood his concern, but she was taken aback by his response to her. Did he not know what she'd just done for him?
"It's not the same," she said. "Varen opened himself up to it in a way I would not invite."
"How can we be certain?"
She held his gaze. "Was it not enough that I brought you back from the dead?" His eyes softened at that. His body relaxed. Uncertainty faded. And so she had no warning when he launched the attack. Reflex alone saved her from the strike. She twisted her shoulders and tilted her head just enough to take a grazing blow on her ear instead of the stunning impact it had been meant to have. But at her dodge, his other hand arced and hooked behind her neck, jerked her forward, and a moment later, he had her locked in a clinch, controlling her head. His knee rocketed up toward her solar plexus. She intercepted it with both forearms just before the impact. When he rechambered his leg, she seized the opportunity, wrapped one arm behind his head, and locked his opposite elbow against her body with her other hand. She stepped into him, straightened, and the movement broke his grip and threw the man off balance. Elith clasped her hands together and snatched him backward, taking him to the ground. She knew she'd be no match for the Azurim. Strength against raw strength. But she'd not met an opponent outside the first house capable of contending with their system of grappling. Even so, it was a mad scramble between them, and though Karush couldn't break totally free, Elith found herself exhausting every method and technique she knew to maintain control. No matter what lock or hold she put on him, the man seemed to know every counter and escape and could apply them in an instant. She couldn't understand what had set him off, why any of this was happening. And all Elith could think was that she had to control his hands, control both hands at all times, because the moment one got free, his weapon would come out and she would die. But they were so fast, and he was so technically gifted, it was clear that no matter how hard she worked to trap them, Karush was capable of matching her effort. It would take only one mistake from her to allow him to get them clear. And there was weakness in her left hand. The two damaged fingers threatened to fail without warning. The two rolled together, weight and gravity constantly shifting. It almost didn't matter whether the man was above, below, or beside her. All Elith focused on was catching that next shift, that next twist. But for all the speed of the exchange, she was slowly, slowly working her way toward a position that would be her salvation. If she could just reach it in time, she would be able to lock both of his hands away from his deadly blade and choke him into unconsciousness at the same time. Her body was so empty, though, so depleted, that she could feel her time rapidly running out. Karush seemed tireless, as though whatever healing she had called forth in him had renewed him to the prime of his youth. Elith's only advantage was that she knew where she was leading the fight, and he remained fixated on trying to reach his weapon. He managed to create space to get his head away from her body, and an instant later, he slammed it into her jaw. There wasn't enough force behind it to cause any damage, but the impact jolted her, and he was able to get his shoulder into a dangerous position. She could feel his hand twisting and slipping away. Elith strove to retain control. In a desperate counter, she rolled their tangled knot over. He ended up on top of her, but the movement threw his balance enough for her to snatch his wrist again, just as he was about to pull away. It cost her all the work she'd put in to achieve that final lock. And more. Though she managed to keep his hands captured tight against her body, she lost control of one of his legs. In that one mistake, Karush swiveled his body in a manner she'd never seen. It was enough for him to sling his elbow. The first attempt caught her on the shoulder, but the second landed full against her ear, momentarily blacking her vision. She felt his hand pop free, and when it went, it took only a half second for him to gain the leverage he needed. Karush ripped his arm fully away from her, straightened it beyond her reach, crushed down on her with all his weight. But he had to angle his body to get the void edge clear, and that angle gave her an opening. If she could seize it before his hand made contact with the hilt of the weapon, she could trap him in the motion, fold him up, and snap his neck before he could unsheath it. It would kill him. She would hate herself for it. But it was his life or hers. But in the instant, between thought and action, the image of his opening attack blinked in her mind. An empty-handed strike. If he'd meant to kill her, why not the void edge? And that thought triggered another. He'd made no attempt to attack her ability to speak. Neither could have been an accident. She shifted her hips, slackened her grip just enough to ensure she could make the move in the right instant, but delayed, giving Karush a window to test his reaction. The hesitation erased her scant advantage. If he went for the weapon, only the faster of them would survive. The void edge was clear. Karush bent his arm, but stopped, hand open. Elith didn't perform the killing technique, but she'd already offered him the only chance she'd give. She rewrapped her legs to gain control of his, launched him sideways, and when she scrambled to take position, he went slack. She didn't dare relax in case it was a setup for some counter. But after a moment more of locking him up, she realized he was no longer resisting at all. When she paused her assault, Karush said something she couldn't quite understand. His voice was thin and distorted by the hold she had him in, and muffled by his own arm trapped over his mouth. Elith eased the hold just a little. "Are you surrendering?" she asked.
"You didn't use your language," he replied, panting.
From the rhythm of the words, she knew he was repeating what he'd said the first time.
"You didn't use your weapon," she answered.
He shook his head as much as he could.
"It is forbidden, if there is neither cause nor intent to kill."
Elith kept him controlled, breathing hard, trying to decide whether or not she should go ahead and choke him out anyway.
"Karush," the arbiter said with obvious irritation, "there are plenty of other, far more sophisticated ways we could have handled that."
"Far slower, too."
"You're lucky she didn't break your neck."
Given the conversation, Elith finally released her grip and shoved Karush away from her forcefully with both feet. She rolled up to a sitting position, crossed her legs, and waited there with her arms resting on her knees. Her energy was gone, but she didn't want them to know that. Karush got to his feet and kept his distance. He was winded, certainly, but otherwise stood there as though nothing unusual had happened.
"Am I supposed to believe you weren't just trying to kill me?" she said.
"If I had wanted to kill you," he answered, "I wouldn't have been foolish enough to take off my armor."
"And what if I had wanted to kill you?"
"It seems that my armor wouldn't have helped anyway."
"Did you put him up to that?" she asked Oyun.
"Me? Absolutely not. I'm appalled."
Elith shook her head, incredulous.
"It isn't wise to test an advocate of the voice," she said. "Even an exiled one."
"Especially an exiled one, I should think,"
Oyun replied. He walked closer to her, offered his hand to help her up. Elith didn't take it. After a moment, he dropped his hand back to his side.
"I overheard your conversation with Varen yesterday," he said, "about the two of you having work to do together. We weren't sure how to interpret it. After his response this morning, you understand our concerns."
"Not well enough, apparently," Elith answered.
"The method may have been crude," Karush said, "but I am satisfied. If you do turn against us now, it will be my third failing, and I deserve whatever fate that would bring."
"I hope it was worth it," the arbiter said, turning to look at the Azirim. "Wasting all that energy when we have a mountain to climb. And what a terrible way to treat the woman who saved your life. Returned it to you, by all the look of it."
Karush squared his shoulders and stood rigidly with his eyes locked on Elith, holding a pose that had become iconic of the Aziri at guard. The sight of such abrupt and powerful formality in the midst of that place stood stark. And then he bowed deeply, bent nearly double, well beyond the range of proper etiquette, and even humble personal gratitude. It was very nearly the bow of one offering full submission to the authority of a sovereign. Elith knew there was no mockery in it, but she didn't know what to make of the gesture. The Azirim returned to his upright position, held it for several seconds, and then relaxed and returned to facing Oyun. Elith looked up at the arbiter, only now picking out the significance of his words.
We have a mountain to climb. You still intend to head to the tunnels then, she said. Unless you see another path, he answered.
If one existed, I would certainly be on it, Elith said. But what are we going to do about Varen?
It was hard for her to think of him as the same man she had taken to calling grief.
What can we do, Elith? Oyun said, turning briefly to look at the ruined hillside. He's buried under half a mountain. And who knows how deeply?
I'm not sure he's dead.
Neither am I. But if he survived, then he is off on his own path once more. If we're fortunate, he may find his way back to us. If not, he'll show up when and where he chooses, dead, alive, fortunate or not. All I know to do is continue.
She remained seated, taking a few moments to breathe and settle her heart rate.
Is what he said true? She asked. About Deep Cutter? About the barrier?
Oyun weighed the question a moment, but his eyes suggested genuine consideration rather than any sort of intent to deceive.
Partially, yes, the Arbiter said. How much of it is true is still yet to be determined. There does seem to be some sort of, we're not even sure what to call it, honestly. Barrier seems too strong a word for it, in my opinion. Neither matter nor energy seem appropriate. But you could think of it almost like an atmosphere, except instead of enveloping a single planet, it appears to wrap around our entire galaxy, and every probe we sent to test it, we lost.
Varen said it was put there. That implies it's artificial.
Varen is quicker to imply many things than I'm comfortable with. But artificial is a funny word.
Artificial.
Crafted. Not natural, he said, and then he stamped his foot three times. Not so long ago, I would have refused to entertain the idea that what I'm standing on right now could possibly be artificial. But now?
He chuckled.
Now I'm starting to wonder if there's anything that isn't.
Elith took a moment to breathe. So much had happened. So many extraordinary events had stacked one on top of the other that she felt she'd finally become numb to them all. Even looking at the scar in the hillside that Varen had left when he disappeared evoked no response from her now. It was just another thing that had happened, and it felt distant, as though it had all happened to someone else. She clambered to her feet and looked off at the mountain as she walked slowly over to join the two men. This close to that peak, it seemed to exude a dark energy, and Elith got the sense that she'd been walking in its shadow ever since the moment they touched down.
Well, artificial or not, that mountain's still waiting for us, she said. I don't think we need to bother with breaking camp.
We'll move faster, and if things go well, we'll have plenty of time to get up there and back before we run out of light. I don't suspect we should assume things will go well.
If that's the case, she replied, then we won't be needing any of this at all.
The three of them returned to their tiny camp, loaded up their essential gear, and secured the rest. As reluctant as they all were for him to do so, Kurush was forced to leave his suit of armor behind. The damage to the centerpiece had disrupted the assisted movement that made the suit fully mobile, and without its support, the suit was simply too heavy for the journey they had ahead. They found Varen's soft armor laid neatly inside his shelter, though, and after some convincing, Kurush eventually agreed to wear it. When they got underway, leaving the clearing behind made Elith feel unexpected remorse. They'd done nothing to collect any of Subo's scattered wreckage, and it felt too much to her like leaving the unburied body of a companion behind. Kurush seemed unfazed by it, though, and she tried not to let it bother her, either. Even so, knowing it had only been a machine didn't reduce her sense of loss or guilt. The number of times she'd witnessed it faithfully guarding and protecting them made it seem more akin to a beloved warhound than a piece of equipment. And Varen. Varen had died there, too. Whether he'd survived the collapse or not, the man she'd known him to be was dead.
Karush's words lingered in her mind, that she could have done more to stop him. Could she have? She'd had plenty of warning. But she'd thought, too, she realized, that she would have had more time, that she would see it before the decision point came, and that she would coax him back or confront him. She'd waited too long, had kept him at a distance while she focused on the planet. Now it seemed like she should have done the reverse. After half an hour of walking, her body fell into its normal rhythm, finally beginning to feel stronger. The physical weariness didn't wear off, but it became easier to bear as the after effects of her use of the deep language dissipated. She glanced over at Karush, recalling the burst of power that had flowed through her and into his broken body. Its toll had been greater than she'd expected, but then so had its results. During the hike to the foot of the mountain, her mind leaped from thought to thought in an endless chain, but as they drew near to their destination, the rugged terrain demanded greater attention, and she was grateful to have something seize sole possession of her focus. They reached the point of ascent before the sun had peaked, and after a few minutes of searching, they started up the best route they could find. The path was narrow, steep, and covered with slate-like chips and debris, and all three of them lost their footing at least once in the first 50 feet. They walked single file, with Elith in the lead and Karush guarding the rear, leaving enough room between so that if one of them went down, they'd be less likely to take one of their companions with them. She kept her navigation piece readily accessible and checked it frequently. As many times as they were forced to switch tracks and zigzag up the slope, it would have been easy to end up above their target. And though the amount of elevation they had to gain wasn't extreme, the amount of fight every step required made the journey much tougher than it otherwise would have been. The temperature worked against them as well, especially in the areas shaded from the sun. The chill passed right through Elith like a wraith. By the time they were a quarter way up, they were all grateful to have left much of their gear behind. The path was so steep in spots that they often had to brace themselves with their hands on the ground as they made their way up, and even the lightweight packs shifted enough to complicate their already treacherous footing. As they neared their first 1,000 feet of elevation, Elith topped a steep incline and nearly let out a little cry of joy. Just ahead of her, the side of the mountain flattened out in a wide, natural shelf, perhaps 20 yards wide. The area was in full sunlight, and patches of long grass stirred by the ever-flowing air of the mountain rustled and whispered softly. Compared to the worst sections of the climb, the temperature in the sun felt almost balmy. The three companions crossed onto the surface, and without even discussing it, dropped their packs for a much-needed break. From the edge of the shelf, Elith could look back over much of the ground they'd already covered, and seeing their starting point far below reminded her of just how far they'd come. It was easy to lose sight of progress when all she could see was the next step, and it boosted her spirit to see that their efforts had not all been in vain. After several minutes, Karush joined her at the overlook and stood silently at her side for a time, straight as a rod, hands clasped behind his back. Eventually, though, he spoke.
"I think perhaps Varen may have been right about one thing after all," he said. "About Subo."
"That it had a self?" she asked quietly. He shook his head.
"That it shared my soul."
There was still no emotion in his voice, no expression on his face to hint at any feeling of loss or grief, but he stared out over the landscape below with the unfocused eyes of a man seeing not that which was in front of him, but rather something within. "Subo was a good protector," she offered.
"I've been its handler for almost 16 years, he said, and his mouth drew back with a hint of a smile that faded soon after it appeared. "I wonder if this is what it's like to lose a limb."
They stood together in silence again, Elith knowing well enough how burdensome unnecessary words could be in the midst of pain. He closed his eyes and lifted his chin slightly. If she hadn't known better, she'd have thought he was mimicking Varen and his habit of pausing every so often to feel the sun on his face or wind on his cheeks. Karush nodded to himself.
"I have no category for you, Elith," he said, without opening his eyes. "I had forgotten what it was like to feel something other than pain. I can't decide if you've given me a great gift or placed me under a greater curse."
"I'm afraid I considered neither," she said. "My only thought was that a man of your caliber shouldn't suffer such an end, though I confess I don't understand how being released from such suffering could be taken as a curse."
"It's only that I see how much of my life I have missed because of it," he continued, serious now. "My life has been small, focused on enduring each day, on doing the task at hand, on my duty. My service has taken me to many worlds. I have no memory of how the wind felt on any of them."
"Your life has not been small, Wari Karush," she said. "Yours has been spent in noble service, and I doubt there is an Azurim more devoted to your way."
"I think perhaps I am a coward."
The statement struck her as so patently absurd, she made an involuntary sound of disgust. "You? The man known among his warrior tribe as the Godbreaker?"
"It's easier to be a savior than a leader," Karush said, "to rise to one moment rather than stand unmoving in the tides of many. Even a would-be savior can fail and yet be honored as a martyr. And that is easiest of all. Easiest of all to be a martyr. Easiest of all to no longer have to live under the burden of your convictions.
If you are a coward, then your way must be a harsh standard indeed by which to measure yourself."
"The standard of perfection? Yes. Harsh in that the closer you are to it, the more intolerable imperfections become. However slight, they may have appeared before, but that is not a fault of the way. There is no malice in it. It is simply its nature. And beside it, mine stands judged. But in this case, I am not speaking of the way. I'm merely using whatever measure you hold for yourself."
"Karush, either the air is getting thin, or you suffered more damage than we realized. I don't think you know what you're saying."
"I do. It makes you uncomfortable to hear it.
Mostly because a couple of hours ago I thought you were going to kill me."
"I remained because of a duty. I remained here only because my fear of failing the Aziri outweighed my fear of this place. Fear on fear. But you are under no such obligation. You remain solely because of a commitment you made to yourself alone. If I had known such leaders existed in your house, I would have thought more highly of it."
"I'm no longer of the house," she said, "and I've never been a leader."
"You've been our leader since we arrived."
Elith didn't know how to respond to Karush's sudden torrent of apparent praise and admiration. But she knew the strength of commitment the Aziri made to speaking the truth. He wouldn't have spoken the words if he hadn't meant them. And now that he had, his mood lightened, as if their weight had burdened him for some time. He reached up and grasped the braid of his beard under his chin, ran his hand down it, then nodded to himself once more, satisfied.
"I'm glad that our brief clash wasn't genuine," he said abruptly.
"So am I," she answered. "If it had been, you would have drawn your weapon, and I'd be dead."
"That is far from certain."
She glanced over at him. He was not a man given to flattery. For him, it was a statement of fact. The Azirim caught her look out of the corner of his eye, and though he didn't turn to her, he did respond.
"I have broken one god in my lifetime," he said. "I don't believe I could do it again."
After that, he turned away from her and strode off. Elith glanced over her shoulder as he walked toward where they'd left their packs, and was surprised to find Arbiter Oyun standing a few feet away with an oddly amused expression on his face.
"Did you catch all of that?" she asked.
"Enough of it.
Any chance you can explain it?"
"I suspect there are few who can explain their ways," he said, turning his gaze to Karush. "But between that and the bow he gave you earlier, I do believe you've acquired the adamantine loyalty of the Lion of the Aziri."
Elith looked again at Karush, but his back was to her as he checked their gear.
"Don't abuse it," Oyun added.
Karush donned his pack. The Arbiter gave her a slight bow and held out his hand, ushering her to do the same. It was time to move again. Elith loaded up and took point, crossing the remainder of the shelf to where it once more narrowed and began its climb up the slope. The paths farther up the mountain grew steeper and trickier to navigate, but thankfully the natural terracing proved to be a repeated feature. Their sizes and shapes varied significantly, and it was never clear what had caused their formation. But they provided welcome and much-needed stopping points as the three continued their ascent. It was early afternoon when they reached their target elevation. All that remained, then, was to find a way to navigate across the mountainside to the tunnels and locate the best entry point. Elith spotted the first craggy mouth within 20 minutes, and though it was much too narrow for them to access, it served as a good landmark by which they could get bearings on the others. From that first cave, the side of the mountain curved inward before jutting out sharply again some 1,000 yards distant. The three of them worked together to identify potential access points on their navigation units, and then divided up the visible regions of the slope among themselves to speed their search. On the devices, 4 of the openings seemed equally viable. Now they just needed to identify which of them had the most accessible approach. They each scanned their designated portions of the mountain with their monoculars for a few minutes, locating 2 of the 4 relatively easily. Either seemed promising. But Oyun wanted to find the other pair before committing, just in case another proved easier to reach. While they continued to search, Karush grunted and lowered his optic. Elith glanced over at him. He continued to look across the gap to the distant face with his naked eyes. "Find something, Karush?" she asked. He raised the monocular again, adjusted it, stared through it for another 30 minutes. Then, without taking his eye from the device, he gestured to her.
"Take a look yourself," he answered.
Elith stepped closer, and he talked her onto the target until she found the cave entry he'd been staring at. "That one looks tough to get to," she said.
"About 15 feet to the right," he said. "There's a white-barked tree with orange leaves."
She followed his directions, found the tree.
"Okay, now look at the face above it."
Elith followed the tree up, expecting that when she saw the rocky face of the mountain, he would explain what he'd seen. But when her view reached the point, she realized she'd misinterpreted his words. When he'd said face, he hadn't been talking about the side of the mountain exactly. There was a stony outcropping just above the bright orange leaves of the tree, and it was a near-perfect image of a human face. When she saw it, Elith's legs drained of all their strength, and she felt her knees buckling. Oyun caught her arm before she sank to the ground.
"Elith," he said, "what is it?"
"That's Damini," she said. "That's the face of my sister."
Chapter 21. Once Elith had seen the face, It didn't matter that the cave entrance below it was the hardest for them to reach, and no one questioned whether or not they should try for it. All that remained was for her to lead them carefully across and up to it. It took constant effort for her to keep her mind focused on the steps ahead instead of on what they might discover at their destination, to control her pace instead of rushing as fast as her heart demanded she move. The likelihood that any of the members from the first landing team had survived this long on the planet was almost assuredly zero, but Elith couldn't dispel the hope of it anyway. The thought that one of her former sisters might still be clinging to life, enduring even now despite every sign of doom around her, burned away Elith's fatigue and drove her onward. It took another hour for them to reach the final climb up to the cave entrance. That last stretch was only 50 yards or so, but the incline was among the steepest they'd encountered, and the first 7 or 10 yards of the path was more like a seam in the mountain than anything anyone but a particularly brave or stupid mountain goat might want to try to walk along. The ledge was about 1 foot wide and angled the wrong direction, sloping downward, away from the mountainside. It wasn't a sheer face all the way to the bottom from there, but the several hundred-foot drop was more than enough to send an icy ripple through what seemed like every one of Elith's nerve endings. She didn't hesitate when she reached it, knowing that if she did, she might not be able to get started again. She sidestepped onto the narrow shelf, pressed as tight as she could against the rock wall to her left, and shuffled up, careful to keep as much of herself in constant contact with the mountain as possible, jamming her fingers into whatever cracks she could find for extra support. At the far end of the seam, the surface widened rapidly out to 6 or 7 feet across, and when her leading foot finally reached that point, she scrambled to it and dropped onto her hands and knees, grateful for the vastness of solid ground beneath her. She held there for a moment, savoring the feeling of stability, breathing, and wondering briefly if she had taken even a single breath while she'd made the crossing. When she stood and turned back to signal the others to come across, Oyun was already halfway to her, and she was surprised at how short the traversal seemed to be from her side. It had certainly felt about 1 mile long while she'd been on it. The arbiter made his way to within 1 few feet of Elith, and she reached out a hand, expecting only to help him catch his balance when he transitioned to the flat ground. The gesture turned out to be the thing that saved him. Just before he reached her, a pop sounded behind him, and his rear hand snapped off the wall like he'd touched hot steel, bits of rock flying out of his grasp and tumbling the great distance below. The sudden movement spun him away from the mountain face, and both his pack and weapon swung out over the void. Elith reflexively caught hold of the top of his shoulder strap and just dropped herself backward, dragging the man along with her. His weight didn't land squarely on her, and from the pull she still felt, she could tell he hadn't made it fully onto the landing. She grabbed at his chest, trying to find anything she could grip, and managed to catch the cross strap of his pack. Oyun rocked quickly from side to side, feet kicking, scraping, and scuffling to find purchase anywhere they could. Finally, he lurched toward her, rolled off to a side, and went completely still. 1 few seconds later, he let out a sharp breath. "Well," he said, "that would have been disappointing." The words came out so evenly, with such little passion, that he could have just as easily been commenting on having nearly dropped his dessert to the ground. Whether it was from the understatement or just pure relief, a laugh bubbled up from within Elith, and she made no attempt to stop it. It had all happened too fast for the terror to hit. Oyun sat up and chuckled as well. "I hope I didn't damage you, dear." Elith scooted up to sitting, still hiccuping short pairs of laughs. The arbiter got to his feet before she did and took her hand to help her up. After he'd done so, He turned back and leaned ever so slightly forward to look over the edge that had nearly claimed him.
"I don't believe I'd like to come back this way," he said.
"I don't believe I want to come this way a first time," Karush said from the opposite side.
"Don't dawdle, Azirim," Oyun answered. "It'll only make it worse."
Karush took a deep breath and stretched out onto the narrow ledge, keeping his eyes firmly locked on the two of them, right up until the moment that he'd reached them safely. They all paused there together, glad to have escaped a catastrophe for once. And then Elith turned and looked up that final stretch, and the weight of what lay ahead fell once more upon her.
"Almost there," she said, though she didn't know who exactly she was talking to, nor if her words had been meant as an encouragement or a warning.
She resumed the climb, scrambling once more on hands and feet up the slope. The last 15 yards or so mercifully rolled flatter, and Elith came up over the rounded top to find another wide shelf, carpeted with moss and clumps of the mountain grass they'd seen elsewhere. It was partially roofed by the mountain face arcing out above it, and on the opposite side, where the edge would have normally dropped off, a thick ridge ran along like a boundary fence, ascending to 20 feet at its highest point. Sunlight filtered through the gap between the ridge and the roof, spilling shadows on either side, and through the middle were features that caused her to stop where she stood. Between her and the far end of the shelf, 20 or so rocky columns rose from the ground at uneven intervals. Each of them were overgrown with thick vines and had dark patches where moss or soil had gathered between the stones. They were somewhere between 7 and 8 feet tall, thin for their height. She'd seen something like them once before. The first time, Elith had mistaken one for the silhouette of a woman.
"We're this close, let's not stop now," the Arbiter said, coming up behind her.
But he stopped at her shoulder, seeing now what had caused her reaction.
"Do you think those are the same as what we encountered in the woods?" she whispered.
The similarities were undeniable, but they lacked the distinct human-like form that those of the forest had possessed. The ones here seemed elongated by comparison, long-limbed, erect along the spine, but more hunched at the top, where the head and shoulders of a human would have been. In general, they appeared cruder, like a rough approximation, or an early prototype later refined into the horrors that they'd fought before.
"I hope not," Oyun answered, "but I see no reason to expect otherwise."
Karush drew up on the other side of Elith.
"The others were smaller," he said. "Just 4 of them gave us trouble, and there were more of us then."
They all stood watching for a time, looking for any sign that the masses of earth and stone might animate or somehow be aware of their presence. But all was quiet and still.
"You're sure this is the way?" Oyun asked.
Elith gave him a sidelong look before returning her attention to the path ahead. The shelf was narrower and far longer than the others they'd encountered, 100 feet or so. At the far end, the slope resumed its rise, sharper there, with large towering rocks embedded within it. If there was a path up that didn't demand climbing, it wasn't apparent from where they stood. But at the end of the shelf, 20 feet up, the cave mouth awaited them. Elith spotted the orange-leafed tree peeking over the ridge, and she followed it to where she'd seen Dimini's image etched into the mountainside. It took her several seconds to locate the outcropping. From her vantage point, though, it was difficult to discern any features that stood out as unnatural. Either the mountain had shifted, or the image had been crafted to be viewed specifically from a certain angle. Neither possibility struck her as encouraging.
"I don't suppose there's another way," Karush said.
"Only if we were coming from the other side of the mountain," Elith answered. Elith looked once more across the shelf to the climb leading up to the cave mouth. The only way to reach it was to pass among the columns, and they were hemmed in on either side by walls of stone, forming a gauntlet. We didn't hear any of that terrible knocking, the Arbiter said. Maybe these have been here for a long time.
Or at least since the first team came through, Elith said.
The strange structures were mostly on the nearer end of the shelf. If she could make it all the way past them, there would be a fair amount of space separating her from them during the climb. Even if they did wake up or come to life, or whatever it was they did, she was confident she could make it up to the cave entrance before they could reach her. She wasn't sure what she would do if they could climb, but she really didn't see any other choice.
I'll go, she said. I'm a good climber. I can make it quickly.
If those things wake up, you won't make it at all, Karush said.
And if we all go, we'll be trapped, she countered. At least this way, if things go wrong, you can fall back across that narrow ledge.
We go together or no one does, Karush said.
Elith looked to the Arbiter for support, but she found none there. He already had his rifle unslung.
Then what's the plan? Elith asked. Fast or slow?
Slow, Oyun said. In our previous encounter, none of them moved until you made contact with one. With any luck, we'll slip through unnoticed.
And with no luck?
Karush said. I suppose we'll try fast.
Karush grunted.
I'll still go first, Elith said, and she took quiet steps forward before either of the others made any reply. The first column stood 10 feet ahead, and as she approached it, she saw that she'd been mistaken to think they lacked the same level of refinement as the others. Just as before, the creations showed uncanny design, reflecting a disturbingly human physiological structure mapped out in earth, plant, and stone. And she realized she'd only considered them crude because she'd assumed they'd been meant to reflect the human form. Now, seeing one from a different angle, she recognized two forms merged into one. The first, Sardis's long features and strict posture. The second, Subo's rounded, humanoid shape. However long these columns had stood, they'd undoubtedly been shaped after her team's arrival. Elith kept her eyes focused on the structure as she crept silently by, ready to dodge away at the first sign of motion. Once she made it several feet past it, she paused, waiting, attentive, to see if her proximity had triggered any reaction. But there was nothing. She continued forward, weaving her way among the others, approaching no closer than absolutely required with soft and certain steps. Though they didn't appear to be arranged in any particular pattern, the columns stood roughly in four rows. As she crossed through the second row, she glanced back to see that Oyun had begun to follow after her, along the same line that she'd taken. Elith returned her attention forward and picked her way across the shelf. The final crooked row of columns had five of the structures, scattered in a loose cluster. She was just passing among the first of them when Karush spoke from behind her. His voice was calm, even, but clear and direct.
Run.
Elith didn't pause or look behind. She just broke into a run, bounding as quickly as the uneven, unyielding terrain allowed, and crossing the last 50 feet in a matter of seconds. When she reached the rock face, it was as she'd anticipated. The only way up to the cave was to climb. She turned back just as Oyun arrived, and Karush was close on his heels.
Go, Karush said. Climb.
They're coming? She asked.
He nodded sharply, looking back over his shoulder at the columns. Elith glanced at them, and though none of them seemed any closer, two had unmistakably changed shape. She turned back and found two good handholds before starting up the wall. It wasn't the most technical climb she'd ever faced, but her damaged hand and the pressure of pursuit complicated the matter. Even so, she was the first to reach the top. She dragged herself over the lip and into the tunnel opening. Elith scrambled up to a crouch, turned back around to lend the Arbiter a hand. He was only a couple of feet from the top, and as soon as he could reach her, they locked hands and she helped pull him up and over the edge. He moved into the mouth of the tunnel, rifle up. She heard him flick a toggle on the weapon, and two thin cylinders ejected from it, one to each side. They hovered 2 feet from the muzzle, pouring blue-white light down into the darkness ahead.
Go, she said, right behind you.
The arbiter moved into the tunnel with quick but precise steps, hunched over his weapon. Elith swiveled back to help Karush clear the last few feet. But he wasn't on the wall. She looked down to the shelf and found him standing there, 20 yards from the climb, looking up at her. When she made eye contact with him, he gave her a curt nod, acknowledging that she and the arbiter had made it safely to the top. And then he turned away to face the waking horrors, alone.
Karush!
She called, but he didn't respond. He just held his ground, stance relaxed, hands at his side. The first of the creatures emerged from the group with long, slow strides, articulated like the many jointed legs of a spider.
Wari Karush!
Elith called again. He looked back at her then and smiled, full, genuine.
Easiest of all.
His gaze lingered for only a moment and then turned to face the stirring constructs. And in a motion almost too fast to follow, Wari Karush whipped the void edge from its sheath and held it out horizontally to one side, arm fully extended. An instant later, the stubby blade unfurled, flowing fluidly into a long, elegant, single-edged sword. The motion of the blade was immediately familiar. It was the same as the reshaping of Subo. When it had fully deployed, Karush brought the blade around and over his head in a slow circle and then snapped it with precision into its initial position. He repeated the same movement twice more, a ritual or a salute to his enemies, and then he did the same a final time, but at speed, and the blade flowed with the motion. It sang a clear, thin tone as it stretched, arced around him, trailed through the air like ink from a brush, and then snapped back into its bladed form. The first construct reached within 15 feet of him a few seconds later. Karush angled his body, drew the weapon back, and in close, blade toward the creature as though he were going to stab it, then dropped his weight backward in a partial crouch, preparing to deliver the strike. Elith tensed. The construct had greater reach. Karush's timing would have to be perfect. But before the creature took a second step, the Azirim lunged forward and shot his arm out. The void edge sang as its blade stretched, streaking toward the construct's torso and passing through it as though it were a mist. With two quick motions, Karush sent a wave flowing along the blade, first vertically, then horizontally. The fluid edge bisected the creature in both directions, before retracting like a lightning strike in reverse. 4 large chunks broke away from the top half of the monstrosity, crumbling on impact with the ground. The legs were still connected to a central portion and took 2 more steps forward. Karush slashed the air. Once more, the void edge lashed out, passing through both stony legs. The remaining structure collapsed 10 feet from him. Elith had thought the Azirim was making a foolish sacrifice. Now, it seemed like he might actually be a stalwart rear guard. She just hoped this wasn't his last stand. 2 more of the constructs were closing in on Karush when Oyun grabbed her shoulder and pulled her roughly into the tunnel.
First 10 yards or so are clear, he said,
half dragging her along beside him until she got fully turned around. His twin lights held steady, showing the way despite the bouncing of his muzzle as he jogged. Elith kept pace, trying to get her bearings as they moved. The tunnel surfaces weren't smooth exactly, but they had a certain regularity of shape instead of the jagged, fractal composition she would have expected. Height and width ebbed and flowed, but those two seemed to hold within some invisible metric. After 30 yards of travel or so, Elith's impression of the tunnel was that they were running down a course left by the root system of some titanic tree. They reached a branch, and Oyun stopped and grabbed her arm. At first, she thought he was going to say they needed to split up, but what he actually said made her feel even worse.
You go on from here,
he said. He was shoving something into her hands. Take this. You've got the dragonflies? She was still trying to process his first words. The question didn't register. What? The dragonflies. Captain Ames' drones. You have them?
Yes, she answered. Yeah, I've got them.
Sync them with this. They'll get you there and back.
Where are you going?
To help keep the Godbreaker alive, if possible, he said. And if not, to buy you what little more time I can.
Arbiter,
do what you do, Elith, he said, already drawing away from her. And maybe we'll make it yet.
He was backpedaling, keeping his companion lights shining on her while he went, and she realized he was doing it so she could deploy the dragonflies. She reached back and pulled the egg-shaped device off the side of her pack and held it next to the device Oyun had so hastily given her. She saw now it was a bulkier navigation unit, running some additional sensor suite she didn't recognize. A single blue light appeared at the top of the dragonfly bundle and then switched green. She'd operated similar drones before. Green usually meant good to go, and though she'd never used dragonflies specifically, she remembered how Ames had deployed them. She popped the flat end against her leg, but instead of throwing the bundle aside, she held it up and opened her palm. The egg fell open like a flower blossoming, six individual pieces separating and tumbling from her hand. They didn't drop far. With a pleasant hum, the dragonflies oriented themselves and moved into formation. Rather than running three on each side of her, though, five moved ahead of her in a fan, each projecting light at slightly different angles to create a wide beam. The sixth floated over her head and stationed itself above and slightly behind her, facing the opposite direction, casting a dim light down on her and sending out a second, more powerful beam to helpfully light the way she'd come. As soon as that last drone was in place, Oyun's lights flipped away from her and quickly disappeared. Had it not been for the quiet hum of the dragonflies, the abrupt sense of isolation might have been overwhelming. She'd operated on her own for her entire time in the house, and for security had kept to herself in her exile. It was only now that she realized she hadn't been alone since she stepped foot on Quell's shadow. The absence of the others felt nearly tangible, and for a moment she wondered how she'd managed to go so long on her own before. Elith turned toward the leading dragonflies and looked at the nav unit the Arbiter had given her. It was locked onto a subsurface location, but the radius of the marked area was larger than she'd expected. He hadn't pinpointed the source. She was going to have to search for it. With a deep, settling breath, Elith attached the nav unit to one of the straps on her pack and then looked down the long tunnel that awaited her. Quell's shadow had thrown so many shocks and horrors at them on the surface, it was hard to imagine anything worse could be under it. But that didn't stop her mind from trying. But Karush and Oyun were out there fighting for their lives. Or rather, fighting for hers. Whatever was waiting for her down here, she'd meet it head-on, at full speed. She reached up and pressed two fingers against her collarbone, deploying her armor's helmet, and before it had even finished unfolding, she began her descent. The early section of the tunnel system proved easy enough to navigate that Elith was able to move through it at a quick pace. It took her only about 15 minutes to reach the perimeter of the Arbiter's search area. He'd already marked up the nav unit's display with grids and an optimized path, so at least she didn't have to concern herself with getting lost or backtracking. The main issue now, though, was simply that she had no idea what she was looking for. She followed Oyun's planned route, trailing behind the dragonflies as they faithfully guided her along. And after another 10 minutes, she suddenly felt as though she'd crossed a threshold. Nothing obvious had changed. The tunnel continued on just as it had before. The dragonflies hummed gently and flooded the way ahead with light, but Elith stopped, nonetheless, to take stock. For a full minute, she remained there, searching her senses and her inner self to identify what exactly it was she felt. And all the while, the mysterious reaction crept like dusk's shadows across her heart and mind. When she finally captured the sensation, it seemed to rush upon her then in all its strength, and she could neither deny nor escape it. It was a presence, the sense that some other being was there with her in the darkness, but not any sort of presence she'd ever encountered before. It had both an unfathomable depth and an overwhelming proximity all at once, as though she were standing at the edge of the highest cliff above the deepest canyon with nothing to cling to. A terrible awe fell over her then, a dangerous, mind-paralyzing awe, without any source or focal point. And her immediate thought was that the mountain itself had become aware of her. Elith felt her training rising to her rescue, could sense it as though the presence had slowed even the speed of her perception. She had been trained to stand before the infinite potential of the cosmos, not just trained, had done so many times. Whatever it was that she now confronted was less than nothing compared to that all-consuming paradox that contained nothing and everything all at once. The shift in perspective helped force back the dread that had threatened to overpower her. It was still there, crouching all around her, but she'd gained the strength she needed to move forward. And 20 feet farther down the tunnel, it was like she'd crossed into an entirely different mountain. Both the size and shape of the tunnel changed abruptly and appeared as though it had been twisted at a bizarre angle. She had to clamber through a narrow passage to continue, and from that point on, the whole system shared the same properties. It was almost like the interior of the mountain had here been crumpled and compressed. Once Elith had that thought, she realized it was quite possible that was exactly what had occurred. She pressed on, and the deeper she went, the greater the weight of the presence became. It was ancient, numinous, and seemed to make the darkness itself dense like heavy smoke or thick incense burning in a sacrificial hall. Though she couldn't see how it would be possible, even the dragonflies seemed affected by it. To her eyes, their beams fell shorter and shorter until it appeared to her that their light could not even escape its own housing. Finally, the oppression became so intense she could bear it no longer. It overwhelmed her and forced her to her knees. Even her will, forged in the refining fire of the first house, was no longer sufficient to raise her back to her feet. Above her, Kurush and Arbiter Oyun had most likely given their lives just to get her to that point. And the sisters of her house, and her former sovereign, how many of them had attempted to solve the riddle of Quell's shadow and fallen before it? She knew she couldn't stand under that terrible presence, but she had strength enough still to crawl. She bent forward onto her hands, pulled herself through that crushing, dreadful awe, one hand's breadth at a time. It was all she could manage, but she would give all she had. And after seemingly interminable effort, she at last broke through. Almost literally, at the sudden release, she pitched forward through an opening into what felt like the purest, freshest air she'd ever breathed. The dragonflies fanned out again, their light shining forth and illuminating a chamber with a high, rugged, but gently curving ceiling that appeared to have been naturally formed. Elith fully expected to find herself too exhausted to stand. But when she tried anyway, she discovered she still had strength in her body. Emotionally and mentally, however, she felt raw and depleted. If there was something important she was meant to find in the chamber, she hoped it would be obvious. She didn't have enough left in her to do much more than wander around. She walked carefully into the chamber and gestured to the dragonflies, signaling for them to push outward and automatically perform a survey of what proved to be the first portion of a fairly wide cavern. There was no sign of water, nor any life of any kind. She reached up and tapped her collarbone, retracting the helmet so she could get a more complete sense of the environment. With quiet steps, she moved along the edge of the space, scanning the floor and walls, evaluating it. But nothing stood out to her as unusual. The strangeness of the approach to the chamber magnified just how unremarkable the chamber itself appeared to be. The dragonflies returned and gathered in a circle about 8 feet above her and hovered there, their collective light pooling down around her. She looked up at them, curious. She'd not given them any command to take such a formation. She turned in a slow circle, looking at the nearest cavern wall, wondering if they'd detected something up there she was supposed to notice. But from what she could see, there was nothing of interest there either. When she looked back down, however, a paralyzing shock wave ripped through her body just at the edge of the ring of light. A ghostly, familiar face was peering back at her.
"Eleth," the Paragon said, her voice fragile, cracking. "I knew you'd come."